Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast of the 24th of January 2016. My name is T.R.P. Watson and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Johnny Fox and Born in London. We're now going to talk about Cymbeline, which is on at the Simonomaker Playhouse, part of the Globe Theatre. This is Shakespeare's play directed by Sam Yates, and it has quite a lot of Globe Theatre regulars, and indeed people who've done quite a lot of work at the Simonomaker Playhouse. This includes people like Trevor Fox, Christopher Logan, Joseph Marcel, Pauline McGlynn, John Joe O'Neill, and Paul Ryder, amongst others. This production also stars Emily Barber as Imogen. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Simonomaker Playhouse wasn't created with the intention of using it for Shakespeare, I don't think. It was created as an indoor playhouse for winter seasons of perhaps Shakespeare's contemporaries and other things. And they experimented, I think the year before last, by putting Julius Caesar in for one or two performances to sort of try it out for Shakespeare, really. And I was lucky enough to see both the main house or the Globe's staging of it as well as the Simonomaker Playhouse, and it was a bit of a revelation of how good but very different Shakespeare's plays could work in this small theatre. So what they've done this winter is they've chosen the four late plays to run through the winter. So as well as Cymbeline, we have Pericles and we have A Winter's Tale and we have The Tempest. And I think that's a really clever idea because, with the exception, I think, of Pericles, these three plays were written for an indoor theatre. And indeed, Cymbeline was, I think, the first play Shakespeare wrote for an indoor theatre, The Blackfriars, where it was also performed by candlelight as well. So it seems completely fitting that they should be putting on these late plays in a candlelit, an indoor playhouse like the Simonomaker Playhouse, which is the theatre that we've all, I think, taken to our heart, really. The play itself, like the other late plays, a bit of an odd concoction, really. I mean, it's anchored in British history, but it's such ancient history, because it's the Roman period, that we actually know little about these times, and in fact, one might even think that it's more mythological than historical. And lots of themes from other plays appear in it, almost as if he's kind of, in the late careers, kind of going back and picking bits from other plays. It's got this kind of otherworldly, fairy tale kind of quality to it. And the central character isn't, in fact, Cymbeline, even though the play is called Cymbeline. The central character is his daughter, Imogen, who's banished because she marries Posthumus instead of Cloten, who's the king's current wife's son by her former marriage, the queen's son by her former marriage. And she's banished, she goes to Rome, but then comes back from Rome disguised as a man. And all sorts of things now begin to happen. She encounters some sort of feral chaps, as I call them, who turn out to be her lost brothers, who've in fact beheaded Cloten, who she was supposed to be marrying. She gets pursued by Iachimo, who comes over from Rome to try and prove her infidelity. And then Posthumus's servant Pisano seeks to punish her, but can't bring himself to do that for the same infidelity. And then she's befriended by some invading Romans who kind of quite take to her. She's a boy, remember? And Caius Lucius and his small band of Roman soldiers kind of take to her and adopt her. And of course, it all ends happily. So it is an odd concoction. But for me, the production they've given here, there's absolutely no props. So there's no piece of furniture or anything in it. And the production has a kind of storytelling quality. And for me, that didn't settle until the second half. I felt in the first half, it felt a bit rushed, a little perfunctory, to be honest. But in all fairness to Sam Yates, the director, who's, I think, a very, very capable director, the play itself does have a lot of these elongated setups, which you have to stage, really. But then the second half is, for me, an absolute cracker. And I really, really enjoyed it as it unfolded, really. There's very, very good incidental music live from Alex Baranowski, where there's some string players up in the gallery. And the costumes in Richard Kent's design, I guess the design is the costumes, really, are very, very good indeed. They do a bit of doubling up. Sometimes that can be a little bit confusing. But I thought there were some particularly good performances in the sort of ensemble. I mean, Trevor Fox I always like, and I thought he was a very, very good Pisano. I thought Brendan O'Hay was very good as Bellarius, who's stolen the king's sons, and Paul Ryder I thought was very good as this Roman soldier Caius Lucius. So I enjoyed it very much, and I'm really now looking forward to seeing the other three. It's the first of the four in this season. I have yet to see, I think Pericles has already started, but I'm going to go and see all of the other three over the next couple of months or so. So to be recommended for me.
I have to say I've enjoyed the other ones. I've already seen Pericles and I enjoyed that, and I definitely enjoyed this. It certainly shows how good the Shakespeare can be done there. I mean, I would always like to see more Shakespeare contemporaries, but I was very pleased to have seen this. And what I liked about it was that it did have that kind of feel that there's so many familiar faces, because I go to the Globe all the time, practically everything at the Globe, and have done it's almost been over for 20 years now. That's a frightening thought. There's these sort of the regular faces, the people who've been in there for, I think in Paul Ryder's case, he's been there for years, but most people have sort of been there for 5 years or so, have been regularly in plays, and it felt almost like you had a rep company, sort of the Shakespeare's Globe rep company doing it, and that might sound like a terrible thing, but it wasn't at all. There was a certain familiarity with the plays, the people having, there was almost a joyousness about this, in that, you know, it's kind of their familiarity with them playing against each other and just creating this play. It felt as if they were having a lot of fun with it without that actually diminishing the play. You know, perhaps it's not quite as dramatic, and it's possibly, given that it's not done that often, it's perhaps a little bit too much of a ridiculous play to take too seriously. But I did enjoy this production, and I liked that feel, almost that cozy feel of having such familiar actors knocking around in it.
Well, I think I'm right that the Globe's only main production in the sort of main space, as it were, of Cymbeline was actually just for two performances, which was the South Sudan Theatre Company, what was at the time the world's newest country, who did a very small-scale Cymbeline as part of the Globe season 2012, which, you know, wasn't the most assured piece of work you've ever seen, but it made up for it in absolute spirit, because it was just thrilling to see these people, you know, the excitement they had coming onto the stage. So it'd be quite interesting to see a main production of Cymbeline on the main stage. And indeed, they have announced that, because they're actually going to do that this summer. But they're changing the name of the play to Imogen, who is, of course, the central character. So I think it's going to be quite a radical production. So it'll be interesting to see and to compare those two.
We're now going to talk about The Rolling Stone by Chris Birch. This is at the Orange Tree Theatre. It's a co-production with the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester, and this play won the Bruntwood Prize for Playwriting in 2013. It concerns a couple of, well, gay men, or a gay man and his family in Uganda. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Yes, it's a play about the treatment of gay people in Uganda. I think it's broader than just the family or the couple at the core of the piece. And I saw it at the end of a week when the Anglican Church was again pandering to the homophobia of African Anglicans, so the timing couldn't have been better in a way, really. This is Chris Urch's second proper play, I think. He's done sort of small works, but it's his second proper play. And the first play, Land of My Fathers, which I saw in the West End at the Trafalgar Studio 2, but started in Theatre 503, was, I think, a very impressive playwriting debut. And what he's done here is he's more than fulfilled his promise for what I think is an even better second play. So I think the first thing to say about it is I think it's extremely good piece of writing, very well structured and very, very well written. At the core of the piece is the relationship between a young doctor, Sam, who's from Northern Ireland, but has a Ugandan mother and is currently working in Uganda in the homeland of his mother. He's practicing medicine there. And a student, an 18-year-old student called Dembe, whose father has recently died and whose brother has just become the pastor of their church. And he has a twin sister. He's very close to his sister and his brother and very, very much part of the church, very religious. The problem, of course, in Uganda is that homosexuality is illegal. And more than that, there is apparently a lot of vigilante activity. So that there's a newspaper called The Rolling Stone. I don't know whether that's its true name or whether it exists. But there's a newspaper which outs people they think are gay. And then subsequently, these people are persecuted, sometimes killed, and their families tormented and ostracized. And that's where the play takes us, really. It takes us into this outing and persecution of gays and how that tests relationships, how it challenges the loyalties of families, friends, and religion. And it's an extraordinary piece that makes you, well, it made me very angry, really. And I just thought it was a very multi-layered, complex play that really made you think about what's happening here. And I thought it was hard to sort of work out, you know, what are the responses are determined by people's fear and what are determined by their genuine beliefs. And that gives it a sort of complexity, really. It's very simply staged by Alan MacDougall in The Round. And in The Orange Tree, of course, that intimacy gives an incredible audience engagement. There are moments when Joe is preaching, brilliantly performed by Sewell Rimmie, where you're really, you know, you're the congregation and he's talking to you and his eye contact is with almost every person in the audience. An extraordinary, passionate moment. And sometimes you feel so part of this debate and discussion, you have to kind of resist the temptation to say what you think and respond yourself, really, because you really do become part of that discussion and part of that debate. And I think that the six outstanding performances, in addition to Sewell Rimmie, you know, we have Julie Moore Cook, who's Sam, and Fiston Barrack, who's Dembe. Their relationship is very believable. And in the more intimate moments, I mean, you do feel a bit uncomfortable, a bit voyeuristic about it, really. We've got Faith Amoli, who's his sister, who has real, for me, real sibling chemistry with her stage brothers. And then we have Faith Alibi, who has to convince us in a largely mute role of Naomi because she's lost the ability to speak for some reason. And then we have this very charismatic and performance by Jo Martin, who's a kind of mother figure called Mama, who's a sort of friend of the family and very much a mother figure. I kind of assumed that the cast had been doing this in Manchester and had come down now for its London run. It was in Manchester last April. But I discovered when I read the programme that three of the cast were actually new. And given that it was only the second performance at the Orange Tree, that was quite a shock to my system because it seemed to me that they were performing as if they belonged together. So I think the six brilliant performances at the centre of the piece, you know, complement this impeccable direction and this very, very good piece of writing. So, you know, for me, I can't think what else you can ask for in a good night in the theatre, really, but something that's, you know, quality through and through and I think essential viewing. What did you think, Tim?
I was also impressed and made rather angry by this. It is a play that does anger you about the way that gay men are treated, well, gays are treated in, certainly in Africa and by people who call themselves Christians. It is an unpleasant thing to watch, that kind of anger. And utterly without point for me. I mean, just, I've never quite seen the point of it. It gave me that anger. It's also a very impressive piece of writing, and to bring that out in me, bring that out, those feelings out, it was, you know, very believable. I do wonder about the way that the Orange Tree is going. I mean, the Orange Tree, I think, to a certain extent, when under the previous artistic director, Sam Waters, the founding artistic director, indeed, you did feel that it was sometimes a little bit cosy, and certainly the audience has changed, radically changed over the last few years. It's radically changed its age and makeup. I mean, it used to be that I would go to the Orange Tree and I would effectively half the average age simply by walking into the room. But these days, you do see an awful lot of younger people there, and it does seem to be not exactly a hip and happening place, but certainly a place where a lot more difficult plays are put on, although they still do something that the Orange Tree is quite famous for, which is sort of rediscovering old classics. And so I do welcome this kind of play in there, but I do also like to see the rediscoveries that they're doing. And I think that it is sort of a theatre in transition, and it is something I kind of welcome, but I'm a little bit concerned about. I mean, I don't know that, I do feel that they've kind of chased away a very old and loyal audience, but perhaps the old and loyal audience are not there for other reasons.
I'm not sure I agree with that. The first thing, I think halving the average age probably is a slight exaggeration, Tim. But I, on Thursday night, it was a kind of hybrid. About half the audience were what I would say was a traditional Orange Tree audience, and half would seem to be a new audience. And actually, the whole audience, you know, gave it a great, great response. And you could see the sort of engagement on the faces of the regulars, as it were, as well as the new people. So I was really pleased by that. More so than when I saw Pomona there, where it felt very much to be angering, I think, the traditional audience. But of course, they are doing, you know, French Without Tears was more of a traditional Orange Tree play. And indeed, I think they're doing a Bernard Shaw, aren't they? The Philanderer soon, which is another traditional Orange Tree play. So they seem to be sort of feeding in new work as well as the work that they're known for. But certainly on Friday evening, I mean, the two audiences sat very comfortably together and both seemed very enthralled by the same piece of work, which was great to see.
We're now going to talk about The Long Road South. This is a play by Paul Minks, which is being done at the King's Head Theatre in Islington. It was done last year at the Hope Theatre, also in Islington, and is directed here by the actress Sarah Berger. It concerns a white family in Indiana who have a couple of black servants. We're in 1965, at the time of civil rights marches. The black servants want to go off to civil rights marches and are finding it a little bit difficult. Paul, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
It is set in 1965 during the long hot summer in Indiana. And the basic premise of this is that the Price family have these two workers, Grace and Andre, and they've been working with them for the summer, and they're hoping to collect their wages so they can head south and join the voting rights marches down south. But the Price family, which is a father, mother, and their teenage daughter, for each of their own reasons, are conspiring to make them stay. Now, the interesting thing about this piece really is that the whole series of the struggle in the 60s for equality and recognition is sort of distilled down into a very microcosm of a middle American family over this one summer. And you kind of think initially after seeing the piece, you think, what was that all about? But actually, it's an enjoyable piece to watch, and it's incredibly funny. But the other thing about it is that the performances do linger with you in the subsequent days. And I think what's really interesting about this is that the play is very economical in what it's saying, but the setup is also very, very quick to actually explain things. So you've got the teenage Lolita, who is played delightfully, annoyingly, I think, as I wrote, by Lydia Perkins, and she tries to manipulate the black gardener, Andre, into staying, first by flirting and showing her body off, and then throughout the course of the piece, she sort of ups the ante at each point, and until the point when he fails to be moved by her, she threatens to blackmail him and tell her father that he seduced her. And the mother, played by Imogen Stubbs, is sort of a wandering drunkard, as though she's come from a Tennessee Williams play. And she's got a dark secret, which is why she drinks, but she also hangs on the black workers, as sort of a crutch to, you know, get things done. And the father, played by Michael Brandon, is sort of got this simmering rage behind him that, you know, there's something about him that's not quite right. But, you know, the thing about this family is that for all liberal-minded that they are, that when the harsh economic realities start to hit and become apparent in this piece, they're none too shy at actually just bringing up the old stereotypes, bringing up the old master and servant type domestic relationship. And against all this prop, you've got the two black actors, Cornelius McCarthy playing Andre, who is the stoic gardener and, you know, turning to God and turning to his faith, you know, to be strong. And his new partner, Grace, who's played by Chrissy Bonn, is the complete opposite, and she has less patience for this. She wants to go down south, she wants to join the race riots, and she cannot understand why he's wasting any more time with these people that are owing them wages. And so you've got this entire setup that it just plays out quite beautifully over the course of 90 minutes. I think the interesting thing about this is that the writer, Paul Minks, covers this period really well, and also the plight of workers, particularly black workers, and their indifferent white employers, incredibly well. And actually, I think he draws from his own experience, because in the program notes, he mentions that when he was growing up, he had a handyman who worked for his father that talked about the civil rights movement. And that was part of the inspiration for this piece. But I think what's impressive about this is it's such a tight little comedy drama from a much bigger story. And What I think is also impressive about this is that it's a new writing, it's a new work, but it's also from a new production company, the So and So Arts Club, which, as you mentioned, was directed by Sarah Berger, who was its founder. And the premise of this group is to sort of give work. It's sort of like an actors cooperative and also an artist cooperative. And this is, you know, showcasing new work. So it was incredibly entertaining and very enjoyable. And I'm looking forward to what they do next. John, what did you think?
I was also very impressed by The Long Road South, both by the standard of the acting and particularly the recognisability of so much of the cast. This is a set of very well-known actors playing at the King's Head. And I think that kind of underscores their enthusiasm for this quality of work as well. Paul Minks, the writer, is a very interesting character. He's not part of this pack of 20-somethings who are turning out a lot of material for The Fringe. He is a man, I would guess, in his 50s. And in fact, I think as he's writing this play about servants who worked more or less for his family, he must have been a very small boy in mid-60s Indiana when piece is set. But now his day job is as a kind of executive coaching specialist at Morgan Stanley, the investment bank. And I really think that's fascinating. I hope he writes a play about it one day. So I think the great thing is that he draws from life. This is a piece written from memory and from personal sympathy for the great plight, but the situation of younger black workers, domestic workers, who are uncomfortable with their servant status and want to go and join the movement in southern United States and find a more independent life. And their discomfort with the working for the family is also reflected in the discomfiture of the family itself. There's a line about them being the only people in their community with black help. And they are a little bit like a relic, I think. And I think they're also anxious because they don't know how they will cope once this working couple leaves them. 1965 is an amazing period in American history. It is a period for the black movement of considerable hope and advancement, but also of tremendous nervousness because it's that anxious period between the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, who was obviously a champion for the movement, and Martin Luther King, who, you know, would eventually be assassinated at the height of the movement's success. The other thing I really like about this piece is it's set almost in real time. Yes, it's only 90 minutes, but during that period, you know, the family has a kind of grill out on the patio dinner, and the servants put their case for being paid and being excused so that they can leave. But as Paul says, you know, every single one of the family has some kind of justifiable reason to put an obstacle in their way. The daughter, which is a wonderful, horrible, accurate performance by Lydia Perkins. I mean, she is one of the nastiest teenagers you could ever come across, a lying, devious, manipulative cow. But it's a tremendous tribute to the young woman's acting that she delivers this hateful character.
We just want to say that, Lydia, you're wonderfully horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, Lydia, you're the actress we love to hate. And then the mother. This is a marvellous performance by Imogen Stubbs. I mean, she really is a classic fallen-apart Midwestern housewife. You know, Blanche DuBois, the bottle has become her crutch. She's been robbed of any kind of taste or discernment because she's slapping about on the edge of sanity in a lime-green negligee and weepily demanding this black servant kneels down and prays and protects her. I mean, it's just... It's not Grand Guignol because she pulls back from that, but it is a wonderful portrayal of a woman who has just lost her personal plot. And then late to the party, you've got Michael Brandon. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of work that the father is introduced very late in the discussion because he's talked about a lot, and then he arrives. And Brandon gives this really first-rate study in fine-tuned midlife anger. You know, I'm not saying he's King Lear, but he's certainly a man who is defined by his job, and his personal status is very dependent on that. And it will be giving too much of the plot away to explain how he is distanced from that, but he has to find other features. The thing that I didn't quite get, really, is why the servants have been working for them all summer and are only now being paid. Why they didn't opt to be paid every week and then put aside money until they had enough for the gas to drive their truck down to Alabama. Couldn't get that. And it might make you a bit uncomfortable, really, that you know, why had this family withheld the money from them for quite so long, since they're obviously good workers and, you know, until this moment of crisis, a perfectly decent relationship. Almost kind of stood on the sidelines, although she is part of the plot, is Andre's girlfriend. So I should explain that Andre, the black gardener, already has a daughter from an earlier relationship, and she's in a children's home in Alabama, and they want to go down and claim her from the home and start a family together with her. So his new partner, Grace, played by an actress called Chrissy Bone, and I have to say, I did not know this young lady at all. I've never seen her work, but apparently she's been Coronation Street. And I thought she was superb. I mean, she's like a ticking time bomb. She's stealthy and sardonic and angry, but also, you know, quite clearly keeping the acid in the bottle just until the very last minute. She also has writing aspirations and, you know, is always scribbling something in her notebook. And you know, you kind of know that that notebook is just sort of one vengeful chocolate pie recipe away from Minnie Jackson in The Help. But she's also the person you root for. You want her to have a future. You want her to have an opportunity. It's all done in a 90-minute segment. And I think because there is dramatic tension and that there is a moment where you're not sure if the servants will get away, you're not sure if they'll be paid, you're not sure if Imogen Stubbs will pull herself together enough not to be sort of carted away and to the local asylum. You're not sure what game the daughter is playing and whether she will prevail in her manipulation of the father. And I think that that actually would stretch really well into two acts and an interval. I mean, you almost never hear me say, I wish this play were longer. But what I'm saying is, I think it has enough meat in it that it could actually survive as a two-act play with an interval. So really good performances, as Paul says. Cornelius McCarthy, I mean, really very good as Andre, measures out this complex characterization with very steady confidence. There are lots of different facets to it, and he releases them very, very slowly, which also makes the events more credible. So I was very impressed by it, enjoyed it very much indeed, and, you know, very, very high quality piece. I hope people go and see it.
We're now going to talk about The Picture of Dorian Gray. This is an adaptation of Oscar Wilde's novella about the man who has a painting painted and manages to keep his looks eternally youthful while the painting degrades. This is on the Trafalgar Studios too, and what is, I suppose, special about this version is that it is an adaptation done by Oscar Wilde's grandson, Merlin Holland, which he has co-written with John O'Connor. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
If it tells you nothing else, The Picture of Dorian Gray reminds you that Oscar Wilde was a playwright and not a novelist. This is his only work of prose fiction, and it's been massaged into a script with really minor tinkering and some additional source material from, as you say, Wilde's surviving grandson, Merlin Holland. I'm not really sure what Merlin Holland is famous for, apart from being Oscar Wilde's grandson, because this also reminded me that what he actually is a hagiographic biographer, not a playwright, because the script is pretty badly cobbled together and suffers equally from tedium and predictability. And what they have done to give it some comic potential is to mine Oscar Wilde's most popular plays and pick from Lady Windermere's Fan or whatever, epigrams, which are then sort of handed on sugar tongs to the audience. And it's really a little bit crude. I think in smarter hands, you could get a much better script out of this. And in fact, a lot of other people have done. There have been several finer versions of Dorian Gray, including an extraordinary, supernatural, eerie 3-hour promenade performance last year at Greenwich by the Alchemic Order. This production has had quite a long life, really. It was first presented at Queen's Hall Arts Centre in Hexham, Northumberland, in April of last year, and has toured to 45 venues all over England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland before it came to the St James's Studio last June. That's a very worthy effort, and it sort of looks like a production which is designed for small venues and a fit-up, and it's got a very compact cast. They could all fit in a full cortina and, you know, look as though they have. But I don't think that does justice to the strength of the story, the quality of the original Oscar Wilde writing, and the fact that it's really quite an iconic piece. when it was published by an American magazine in Philadelphia because that placed it outside the British censorship regulations. It was the most scandalously homoerotic fiction yet seen or yet written. And I think Peter Praise's production is just so denatured and so bland that it reduces this material to clay. And at no point do you find the atmosphere on stage charged with anything remotely resembling sexual tension. And you would really think, you know, 120 years after the event, surely two of the men might actually kiss, because it is about men who are probably having sex with each other based on this sudden magnetic attraction between the artist Basil Hallward and his model or muse, Dorian Gray. Instead, you know, it's almost like a pantomime. It starts well enough. You've got, you know, a very nice sort of three-handed scene. Got John Gorick, who, you know, has been here very recently as Oscar Wilde himself in the far finer Trials of Oscar Wilde, in his frock coat and the same wig and same mannerisms. And he's called Rupert Mason, playing really nice and diffident Basil Hallward, you know, very tentative in his approach to this beautiful young man that he sees as his ideal. And then suddenly, after this lovely opening scene, you've got what feels like a little bit of the League of Gentlemen, because the two older men go off and then they come back as kind of duchesses in poke bonnets and big skirts, being kind of all sort of Lady Bracknell-ish with the epigrams over the teacups. It just is not right. And really, at these prices, it's definitely shortchanging the audience, because I think in the West End, you are entitled in a play like this to have principals and some supporting actors, instead of which only Guy Warren Thomas, playing Dorian Gray, plays one character all the way through. The others play six or seven each. And it's really not fair on them, and it's not fair on the audience. And I think it's a piece of cheapness that might be accepted if you're touring to 45 venues, but I don't think it's right for the West End. Apart from that, it's long and it's not really very clever. And they try very hard to get the sort of supernatural element, and the moment when the portrait is revealed as being, you know, old and haggard and damaged, and the young man stays intact. They're working with an empty picture frame, which is quite clever, but I think it needs something in the way of special effects to actually make the audience suspend its disbelief a little bit more than they have done so far. So I think it's a bit hobbled, really, as a piece, and I'm sorry in a way for the cast, because they are good in what they do, but it's, you know, you need something a bit more than willowy flamboyance and a nice waistcoat to lift Dorian Gray off the page. And for me, this production just didn't do it.
What did you think, Paul?
I was also there with John, and actually I think there was a few music. It did lift our spirits a little bit when we saw Rupert Mason in a turban in what I assume was an opium den somewhere in London, as Dorian Gray goes on his escapades and wild and hedonist sprees, which happen mostly in the second act. The other thing also is the intimate space of the Trafalgar Theatre downstairs is wonderful. And at some points you do feel like the actors are almost acting in your laps, given that they block your view. But I think this piece is somewhat coming to be the surprise bomb of the year so far, given the scathing reviews that have come from it. While I didn't think it was that bad, I do tend to agree with John. And also, I think the thing that, for me, that kills it is, if you're going to actually do a compact version of Dorian Gray, it's no point having 30 different characters played by four actors, and let alone three of those actors being men, and having to, you know, camp it up or play pantomime Danes, because it just kills any drama in the thing. A bit more gender balance in the casting, and a bit more choice cuts in actually this script would have probably made this compact version of Dorian Gray a bit more acceptable. I think the other aspect, though, which John didn't touch on, was perhaps also the cast were a little bit miscast for the roles, which also was no fault of them, but it didn't feel like it gelled as a production, which was a shame, because it's a terrific story. And as John said, in this day and age, it was scandalous then. We need to actually have a sense of why it was so scandalous now. And a peck on the cheek even probably would have gone some way to actually give some sense of that. But no, we didn't have any of that. And that was a bit of a shame. But I guess there was, you know, Guy Warren Thomas as Dorian did have the look for the man, but overall the production fell flat for me as well.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.